We interrupt this broadcast with some important news.
Let's rewind and check out the biggest news stories from this week. It's time for Taiwan This Week.
Good evening and welcome to Taiwan This Week with me, your host Gavin Phipps. And I'm joined in the studio this evening by Brian Hugh.
Thanks for having me.
And by Michael Fahey.
Great to be here.
And we'll begin this week with talk of Taiping Island, as the Coast Guard Administration and the Ministry of National Defence held a ceremony on Monday, marking the opening of a new wharf on the island in the South China Sea. Now, the Coast Guard Administration confirmed on January the 29th that a dredging project to allow larger vessels to dock at the wharf had been completed. And now it's been completed, the Coast Guard says that the deeper navigation channel will allow 4,000-tonne vessels to make routine patrols in the waters around the island. Now, neither the Coast Guard nor the Defence Ministry announced what officials attended the ceremony. Well, they didn't make that public, shall we say. Now, the KMT, of course, has been calling on President Tsai Ing-wen to preside over the opening ceremony, but she didn't go. The KMT argued that, well, Chen Shui-bian went and so did Ma Ying-jeou, so you should go. But the presidential office said, well, it didn't actually say, it didn't give any answers as to whether she was going to go or not, and it said only that there would be a public announcement if the president travels to the island. Now, the convener of the Legislative Foreign Affairs and National Defence Committee announced the following day that members of that committee will be travelling to Taiping Island on May the 16th. And according to KMT lawmaker Ma Wen-chun, the trip is aimed at inspecting the new wharf, reviewing other ongoing maintenance projects there, and also getting a better understanding of the garrison's combat readiness. On Wednesday, Foreign Minister Joseph Wu faced questions by lawmakers as to whether Tsai chose not to travel to Taiping Island, and he said that it's currently not an appropriate time for President Tsai Ing-wen to visit Taiping Island due to heightened tensions between Chinese and Philippine Coast Guard vessels in the South China Sea. Now, according to the Foreign Minister, there is no doubt that Taiwan has sovereignty over Taiping Island, but the government believes there are more appropriate times for such a visit, as if it takes place now, Taiwan could be labelled a troublemaker. And on Thursday, National Security Bureau Director General Tsai Ming-yen said that his office believes it's also currently too dangerous for President Tsai Ing-wen to visit the island. And speaking prior to a legislative hearing, Tsai said that China is currently very active in the South China Sea, with sea and air patrols hailing non-Chinese shipping and aircraft transiting through the disputed area. And according to Tsai, the current geopolitical situation in the South China Sea means that the president chooses to visit Taiping Island now, well, such a move could be viewed as intentional escalations of regional tensions. And he went on to say that a presidential visit to Taiping Island could also result in Taiwan being viewed as a troublemaker, much as in the way the foreign minister did. But he went on to say travelling to Taiping Island would be highly unbeneficial to Taiwan's diplomatic interests. So, Michael, I mean, were you really expecting Tsai Ing-wen to go?
No, I did not expect her to go. For precisely the reasons that the National Security Advisor said, which is that the South China Sea is, number one, highly militarized, and there certainly would be a risk to the president going there. And secondly, the United States does not want Taiwan making loud claims about that island and the other one that Taiwan holds, because it irritates relations with the Philippines, which also has claims, and the U.S. wants Taiwan and the Philippines to continue drawing closer, as they have recently, to counter China's activities there. So Chen Shui-bian and Ma Ying-jeou went at the end of their terms, and my understanding is the United States was particularly unhappy with Ma Ying-jeou's visit in 2016. It just adds to the complexities of the issues surrounding the South China Sea.
And Brian, do you think possibly somebody in Taipei got a phone call from someone in Washington saying, please don't go?
That would not surprise me, but particularly it's interesting the way it is framed up then. the KMT wants to reiterate these claims over Taiping Island, and Ma certainly did that to condemnation from the U.S., but this has become increasingly politicized. In the last year, for example, KMT legislators hit out at the fact that there was a freedom of navigation operation regarding a U.S. vessel that was then followed by a Chinese vessel with a claim that it entered into 3 nautical miles of Taiping Island. And the claim was attempting to frame the Tsai administration as not doing enough to protect Taiwan's sovereignty in this sense. Now, what's interesting is actually Tsai was more emphatic on claims over Taiping Island at the start of her term. There was actually a warship sent there and shortly after she took office. But now, 8 years on, she's in a much more consolidated position where she doesn't need to feel that she has to do this. Because again, it would alienate these ties that have been built up with the U.S. And that would be troublesome for the incoming Lai administration, a political administration that already faces this issue, that is labeled as a troublemaker based on Lai's preceding comments about Taiwanese independence, for example. And this takes place after Lai's victory was congratulated by Bongbong Marcos, the president of the Philippines, a sign of these strengthening ties. And so it would be rather unwise to do this, particularly at a time in which the Philippines already has this antagonism towards China regarding conflicting territorial claims. And so having Taiwan involved is not helpful for these warming ties between Taiwan and the Philippines in that sense.
Let's do a quick explainer on this, because Taiping Island is 1,600 kilometers away from Kaohsiung and about 1 square kilometer or so of territory. And it's Taiwan's claim to it arises from actions that the Republic of China, then on in China, took in 1946 after World War II, where it unilaterally drew this 11-dash line, which later became a 9-dash line, around the entire South China Sea, including Taiping Island. And then in 1948, the Republic of China actually sent warships to some of the islands. And after that, things were pretty quiet for decades, although China also made the same claim to the entire South China Sea. Then China began asserting those claims, and the Philippines brought an arbitration case under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which both China and the Philippines are members of it. China refused to participate, and the Philippines prevailed in that arbitration. With regard to Taiping Island, the tribunal said that it was not an island because the criteria for an island is that the island must be able to support human life without human intervention. And I think a lot of people in Taiwan don't understand the nature of that ruling. They look at Taiping Island and they see the vegetable gardens and the, you know, the buildings and the soldiers there. And I think there's even maybe a little temple there and so on. And what the tribunal was saying is that that's only possible because of all the resupplies and, you know, there's not really enough fresh water on the island and there's no historical record that people have had permanent settlements there. So the tribunal said it was simply a rock or a feature that did not generate a 3-kilometer territorial sea. Now, for China, its entire claim to the South China Sea rests on the ROC's previous unilateral claim. It certainly is very eager to see Taiwan continuing to make that claim. And some people think that it would be dangerous for Taiwan to, China would see it as provocative if Taiwan withdrew from the island and therefore weakened the ROC and the People's Republic of China's claims on the island. So it's a pretty complex issue that, you know, international law, such as it is, has ruled that the kinds of rights that you have, not sovereignty, but the kinds of rights that you have under international law, Taiwan and the Philippines and China can't claim them over these islands. They should jointly administer them and settle their claims between themselves.
Yeah, it's not the first time there has been this contention regarding classification of these various islands or rocks, depending on who you're talking to, that are claimed by Taiwan. And it's quite interesting with regards to Taiping Island. For example, around the time of Tsai taking office, it was in the news that there had been a request to Google Maps to blur the island or parts of it because of military installations. And so that's another subsect of it, I think, the military aspect. But it's also interesting that DPP legislators have been among those to call for a visit, which is actually quite surprising. And it does reflect, I think, these complexities, but also that there are some in the Pan-Green camp who do support making these claims and continuing to emphasize them. And so it's interesting in that sense that Tsai also does have to shrug off some views from within her own party. And I think it is quite unwise to go, but I think that's why there is this open debate. And you do have officials such as the head of the National Security Bureau and Joseph Wu coming out openly, actually, with statements, because I think they are also trying to persuade people in their own political camps.
But Michael, I mean, do you think maybe the presidential office should have made a statement?
I don't think that's President Tsai's style, and I think that it deftly and adroitly avoids the president commenting on this sensitive matter that Taiwan's allies in the United States and its potential allies in the Philippines don't want to see.
Do you think that, Brian? Do you think Tsai avoided the subject because she wouldn't want to irk people?
Yeah, I think so. I think that is Tsai's preferred way of doing things, is just avoid the question, the issue goes away. I don't think your average voter is going to be up in arms about this, especially. Though some pan-blue voters may be. But I think that's probably what she's banking on.
Let me play the devil's advocate for a minute and say that Taiwan should simply withdraw from the island or reach some kind of deal with the Philippines to jointly administer it and you know, for maritime safety and that sort of thing. Because, you know, if it's so far away from Taiwan, there's no real interest in it. Taiwan has no connection to it. And, you know, Taiwan back in the 1950s under American pressure gave up islands such as Dachen Island, which the people who were relocated to Taiwan from Dachen Island, I'm sure, feel very strongly about it still. But for the vast majority of people in Taiwan, nobody cares that we lost Dachen Island 60 years ago. And in a few years, if we withdrew from Taiping Island, no one would feel the pain or the itch, butong buyang, as they say in Chinese.
But Brian, that could irk America as well, because it would leave a void, technically.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, if it was in collaboration with the U.S., I think, or if the U.S. is a stakeholder in it, I mean, we have all these questions regarding the ties of the Philippines and the U.S. at present. I mean, they were questioned under Duterte and have now been renewed under Marcos. But if it did occur in coordination that way as a way to cement stronger relations with the Philippines, that would be quite interesting. The question is how that would play out politically in Taiwan. I think it'd be very hard to introduce that idea in some ways. The ideas of cementing ties with other countries in the region that could be potential allies through relinquishing sovereignty claims. But it'd be very interesting as a proposal. I think that is something worth considering in that sense, because I do think that there is a lot of risk associated with this, and it doesn't gain a lot for Taiwan. And Taiwan has this potential then to be mired in further tensions with China and other potential allies in the region because of Taiping Island.
Giving up the sovereignty claim wouldn't necessarily mean withdrawing from it. The South China Sea is historically, there's a lot of smuggling. There are fishermen there who, you know, sometimes get lost in typhoons and that kind of thing. The Coast Guard, through a joint administration with the Philippines, could continue to stay there. And the military aspects of it, the strategic aspects of it, would continue to be relevant as well. There are many ways of handling this issue.
But would it still have a Kaohsiung postcode?
Why not?
Well, I mean, it could. It's interesting because actually I do think a lot of goodwill towards Taiwan in the Philippines is driven by tensions with China in the South China Seas and West China Seas. So I think it's one of those issues in which it's preferable to actually cement better ties rather than alienate.
Moving on now, and people took part in an event on Monday outside the Legislative UN in Taipei, marking the 10th anniversary of the Sunflower Movement. Now, the rally was just one of several events which are being organised this week by the Economic Democracy Union to remember the student movement that occupied the Legislative UN on the evening of March the 18th of 2014, in a protest over the government of then-President Ma Ying-jeou seeking to ram through the passage of the Cross-Strait Services in Trade Agreement. They occupied the Legislative Chamber for 23 days, and outside the building, the protest covered several city blocks. Some, of course, remember this fondly, while others have less fond memories, and some simply snarl and grit their teeth, especially the people that lived in the area who were none too happy about it. So, Brian, of course, big thing for you, mate, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's when I was a student and I participated in the movement. I was right out of college, and that's how New Bloom magazine, which I founded after the movement, began. And so I was there as part of it. It was much larger than I expected. And it's interesting the way the historical memory of the movement was still contended over. Part of the framing was lashing out at Huang Guoqiang, for example, formerly of the New Power Party and now of the Taiwan People's Party, as well as Ko-in-jin. There's a wave of anger directed towards them, an emphasis on the movement as consisting of regular people, rather than these political stars that came out of the movement. And there's a lot of questions that have been raised about Taiwan's links to other situations in the world in which democracies are under threat. There's a speaker from Ukraine, and originally there was a speaker that was planned from Hong Kong, but she was sick. And so it's quite interesting, actually, looking back on this. And there was a lot of familiar faces, at least for me, when I was there that night.
But, of course, it was called a student movement. And just because you were a student, Brian, was it really a student movement?
At the end of the day, that's interesting, the framing, because I think students had a particular role in Taiwanese society going back to the history of student movements. And so the focus and the framing of the movement was on the students in the legislature. But of course, maintaining occupation for 24 days would not be possible with support of NGOs and civil society and regular everyday people from all walks of life. But it is remembered sometimes as a student movement.
And the president of the Legislative Yuan,
yes,
who didn't kick them out.
Which is quite interesting, actually, that there was the split in the KMT that allowed for the students staying there. Wang Jingping was the head of the seen as the head of the pro-localization faction, the KMT, and of course, Ma Ying-jeou, as the head of the mainlander faction, wanted him out. And so Wang Jingping did not want the police kicking out the students and made sure that did occur. That's why some events in the movement played out very differently in other government buildings, such as the executive branch, Taiwan's executive branch of government.
Do you think, Michael, that the fact that the police didn't take an action when they occupied the Legislative Yuan helped certain people, helped both the KMT and the DPP and the student or the Sunflower Movement to get all of them, really?
Well, I think the gentle response, at least around the legislature, reflected very well on Taiwan and its commitment to democracy on all sides. Students do have a special place in society, and beating them up or injuring them, which would have inevitably happened if the police had removed them by force, would have looked very bad for President Ma and his legacy. And I think that if we contrast this to the very heavy-handed approach that was taken in Hong Kong, and also if we look at some of the things that happened in Thailand and certainly Burma, Myanmar, you know, Taiwan looks great as the way it handled it in the end. For me, I was, perhaps you would call me a Sunflower Movement skeptic at the time. I found it very moving. My office was near the legislature, so I went over a few times, and it seemed like everybody was having a good time. And then there was a very large protest that occurred and a concert, and I noticed a real uptick in civic discussion, I generally thought it was a good thing, but I didn't see its historical significance at the time. Over the years, and looking back at it now from 10 years in the past, I think it's fair to say that it was a major event in Taiwanese history that created all kinds of changes, deintegration with China economically. It swept the DPP into power. It put Mayor Ko-in-jin onto the stage and allowed him to now have the TPP, and his stalwart ally, Huang Guoqiang, got his start there as well. So its effects rippled all through society over the last decade. I do think its political charge has run its course at this point. It's no longer, but in the long term, we will see, just like with the Wild Lily movement, in 10, 15, 20 years, we will see people who were involved in the Sunflower movement, not necessarily the leaders, assume prominent political roles, and that experience will shape Taiwan's future in the long term as well.
Yeah, I think what is quite interesting to me is the fact that that's been the case. The DPP, for example, its young slate of candidates is always drawn from the same set of people that were prominent figures in the Sunfire movement. At the same time, I think there's this focus on young people after the movement as willing to take risks for society in that sense. And so it had a powerful impact, I think, on the last decade, though the question is now, does it still last as an impact? What's actually interesting about the last set of elections was I saw for the first time candidates referring directly to the Sunfire movement in those terms as part of their political careers. In the past, there was actually an attempt to kind of downplay it or frame it differently, but with 10 years after, it takes on this kind of veneer of respectability. 1,000 people or so, or several hundred in that scale, on Monday night was not bad, I thought. But it's interesting to me that then a lot of the political ideas regarding the Sunfire movement have not been resolved. For example, the cross-strait services trade agreement is now on the table again, or at least publicly discussed, resuming talks as proposed by Ko Wen-je himself and the KMT, which was in some ways following on Ko's coattails in proposing that. And that was what came up, I guess, a lot of the discussion, as well as that the people that are in the movement now in very different political positions. There's actually a lot of difficulty commemorating the movement officially, because the legacies of the people involved are still at stake, and so do you invite? There have been controversies, and who knows where people will end up politically when one has seen someone like Kwang Kwo-chang change political affiliations.
So, I did look at the newspapers and the press this week and found some headlines in the international media about this, Brian. So, I'm going to ask you some questions as these headlines posed to me when I read them on the interweb. One headline, Sunflower Movement Transformed Taiwan's Political Map. Yay or nay?
Well, I think so. I mean, for the reasons we discussed.
Absolutely. It underwrote President Tsai's first electoral victory, and also, perhaps even more significantly, allowed the DPP to take a majority in the legislature. Her very successful term, I think, would not have been as transformative if she and the DPP did not have control over the legislature. And that was directly caused by the Sunflower Movement.
Sunflower Movement set right economic path for Taiwan, Brian.
Well, I mean, I think there's a larger structural factors that really have shifted Taiwan's place in the role regarding China and the U.S., and so I don't think that can all be credited to the movement.
The blocking of the services agreement was a pretty important event in Taiwan's economic history. Had that passed, it would have been possible for people from China to come to Taiwan and invest and stay here. And it would have increased Taiwan's dependence on the Chinese economy in ways that I think would have had, we would be in a very different position than we are today, where Taiwanese exports to other places are increasing, investment in China is going down, and Taiwan is generally economically decoupling very quickly. And it's been shown that China was not Taiwan's only economic choice. It was possible to have a very healthy economy without so much reliance on China. Now, of course, Taiwan is right next to China. China is, you know, incredibly big. Its economy is incredibly dynamic. Taiwan would like to have good economic relations with China, normal economic relations. Taiwan does not want to be, you know, the China's Cuba, as it were, you know, isolated from its nearest and biggest neighbor. So there are many choices for Taiwan, but I do think that at least for now, it set Taiwan on a different path than it otherwise would have taken economically.
And Brian, of course, there has been talk within the new legislature, the KMT, and even the TPP, of revising the services agreement. I mean, do you think this could happen? Or do you think we could see another sunflower movement called some other flower movement? The azalea movement?
Well, it's interesting because of the fact that the idea has come up again, and I feel as though it provoked such backlash last time, and I wonder why the KMT is pushing for it again or did not try to repackage the idea. Just back to the CSSTA, one could call for increased economic engagement under a different name would not provoke such emotions in that sense. So I do wonder. It is true that the civic society is not as strong as it was 10 years ago because of the fact that the Bond administration had many years in office in which to irritate civil society and allow for building strength. There would be some protests in some form, but it would often, I think, be channeled through more electoral means or in collaboration with the DPP at this point rather than occur as a social movement that involves forcible occupation of government buildings, perhaps.
And finally, Michael, here's another headline. House Sunflower Movement Let Young People Speak Up. So did it let young people speak up? And are they still speaking up today? Because it's gone away, sort of like.
I would say that what I noticed was, you could say speaking up, but I think more importantly, young people really surprised me by speaking among themselves about politics and civic society in a way that I hadn't seen before. And it is really significant because they're kind of the first generation to come of age fully and to grow up with no lived experience of the martial law era. And they're very different from people who've had experience in the martial law era. They think differently. They have different values. I mean, there's always generational gaps, but this one is pretty profound. And I think they found their own voice. The difficulty is that there's not as much intergenerational communication between the people who lived during the martial law era, who are now in their 50s and 60s, and everyone under 40 who did not. They're kind of talking past each other in some ways. And in some ways, the promise of the Sunflower Movement, they had much more in mind in the end than just blocking the services agreement. There was a brief utopian moment where I think young people thought that they were going to transform society into a much more progressive Taiwan. And we've seen steps in that direction, but that part of their vision has not been realized, and we'll have to see whether that comes back to inform their imagination of Taiwan's future. I think it will.
Yeah, we didn't have a Taipei commune, we could say there, Michael.
Well, I mean, there were some attempts after
there were some attempts afterwards.
So, Brian, I mean, do you think it was a great way and a movement that led young people to finally speak up after being called strawberries for so long? And are young people still speaking up?
So it's interesting because it did crystallize, I think, views, political views from young people. And the fact that young people are pro-status quo and not pro-unification, but also not pro-Taiwan independence, is something that crystallized through the movement. The term natural independence generation was coined after, for example, to refer to young people that naturally consider themselves independent from China, but then do not feel a need to declare independence. The movement leaders were generally pro-independence, but sought to avoid that perception in the public eye until relatively late in the movement. And I think that actually then does feed into a lot of the current political positioning of the DPP at present. The DPP did try to come in, for example, with the traditional identity politics early on in the movement, and that was rejected by students. And so then one sees the Tsai administration avoiding that studiously, and William Lai as well, despite historically having leaned to some of that. And in that sense, young people did feel empowered to enter politics, and the age of some of the politicians and legislatures some are quite young and came out of the movement. I think it's another interesting phenomenon, and there's a lot of people that joined politics in the wake of the movement. So I think it did have that impact in such a way.
I think it had an impact on the KMT as well. I think that you see some younger politicians like Xu Qiaoxin, who are basically of the same generation, who got the idea that even in the KMT, there needed to be a voice for younger people, and they were going to push their way to the head of the line, as she very much did. And so you can say that she was influenced as well, even though she just came out saying that basically saying that the Sunflower Movement was a failure and everybody involved in it was a loser who's been rejected by the voters, all of which is totally untrue. The Sunflower Movement succeeded in blocking the services agreement, changed Taiwanese history, brought Tsai Ing-wen into power. And it's true that some of the very progressive candidates have not found electoral success yet. But they've done pretty well, and they're building a political basis. So she better be careful that she doesn't get voted out by one of them in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting, her political trajectory. I mean, she actually began as one of the young people in the KMT calling for reforms for its pro-China image, but now she has leaned much more heavily into traditional party positions. But in the beginning, she was actually perceived as part of this generation in some strange way. And so people from the Sunflower Movement were actually quite supportive of her when she initially politically debuted. And that led to allegations against her within the KMT of being another turncoat within the party.
I want to give a shout out for the parents of the Sunflower Movement, who I believe played a important and quiet role in the whole thing. the parents of the Sunflower Movement are people who came of age in the 1980s and perhaps in the 1980s, basically. And certainly not all of them, but many of them were very politically aware and very progressive and liberal at that time, and supported, or at least did not oppose, their children's political activities, which I think made it much easier for this new generation, or that then new generation, to find its voice. The really interesting thing is what's going on with the younger brothers and sisters of the Sunflower Movement. I guess we would call them Generation Z or something like that. People who were born, you know, around 2000 or so, and who seem to have, you know, for example, there was a lot of youth support for Kowinja, who is center-right at best and nowhere near as progressive as the Sunflower Movement was. So do we have a more conservative generation below the Sunflowers? And what will their political movement be in the future? But I think that if the KMT tries to force through a service agreement in the legislature, there will be an immediate and profound reaction against it, and people will be out on the streets opposing it.
And moving in a completely different direction now, Health Minister Shwe Ryuen on Monday apologised for the death of a one-year-old boy in foster care after allegedly being abused by his caregiver. And speaking at a legislative hearing, Shwe apologised to the boy's family and to the public for what he described as a lapse which led to the loss of a life. Now, that happened as Labour Minister Xu Ming-chun this week announced that the government is now formulating guidelines to protect the rights of pregnant migrant workers. That statement came after the death last Friday of a six-month-old son of two undocumented Indonesian migrant workers. Now, the death of the local child, who allegedly was beaten by his caregiver, sparked a public outcry. First of all, there was a proposal for calling for a blanket death penalty for child abuse cases posted on a government administrative public policy online participation network platform. Now, immediately got thousands and thousands of supporters, which means that the Ministry of Justice now is obliged to respond to that by May the 14th. In the case of the undocumented Indonesian migrant worker's child, the Ministry of Labour basically said it's now going to draw up guidelines to cover the rights of pregnant legal migrant workers and their employers. However, it didn't actually touch on the status or what could happen to the children or newborns of undocumented migrant workers. Michael.
The petition online reflects the outrage that Taiwanese society felt, and also the strong support for the death penalty. I believe 80% or something of Taiwanese support the death penalty, and we have a big constitutional court case coming up on that. So these things are all in play. The Ministry of Justice is simply going to turn around and say that Taiwan has enacted two international covenants on human rights, basically, and one of those commits it to gradually phasing out the death penalty and reserving the death penalty for only the most extreme cases, which in court cases, typically you have to commit truly vile crimes, multiple murders, before you can be sentenced to death today. Death sentences are increasingly rare in Taiwan, and Taiwan is simply not going to enact or carry out a law that imposes only a death penalty on this kind of case, no matter how much the public wants it. So I see that as letting off steam in some ways. More generally, what we've been seeing the last month and a half from the two little girls who are now still in comas down in Zhanghua after they were hit by a truck, this death in foster care of another child, the death of a migrant worker child, and then another one who was brought to the attention of the authorities, who they initially thought might have been abused. And now it now seems that the migrant worker children, the preliminary findings is that they were not abused, although one is dead as well. And you know, Taiwan is facing this demographic crisis. There's, you know, the number of children being born is going down every year. They're a precious resource that our society cares about deeply. And we're distressed and disturbed to see that the children of the vulnerable are dying or being abused. The problem of migrant workers is particularly acute because NGOs estimate that there is at least 10,000 of these undocumented children in nooks and crannies around Taiwan. And, you know, you have to question whether or not that child died because his caregivers or parents were afraid to bring the child to the hospital to seek medical treatment until it was too late because of their undocumented status. So I think there's a concern about the government's failure to prevent these things. And let's remember that Taiwanese people believe that the government can help in things like this. And they're disappointed when they don't see the government or failures like this, and they want to see something done about it.
Yeah, I think it's quite telling to me about the nature of Taiwanese society that there's outrage about one death and not the other, though, particularly regarding that there is not as strong a reaction to the death of the undocumented migrant worker child. In the case of the infant in foster care, the child in foster care, some of the outrage has been directed at social workers for not doing enough to carry out inspections. And then there has been pushback from union groups, for example. But I think it also reflects that there's a failure to reckon with some of these deeper issues at stake in Taiwanese society. For example, there are abuse cases that occur often in schools with physical punishment, corporal punishment, cases in which children that have disabilities were tied up, for example, in Taoyuan in 2 years ago, I believe. And one died and the other suffered brain damage. But there's not this massive social outcry the way there is now because this case has become zoomed in on by the public. And the issue of the undocumented migrant worker children, I mean, it's very large. It's been going on for a while. There's the issue of children of undocumented migrant workers. There's the issue of particularly when migrant mothers are divorced and maybe pushed out of the country and so go off the grid to stay with their child. I mean, reportedly, there's an entire village in Taiwan somewhere consisting of just children like this, and the government is aware of this. And the issue regarding undocumented migrant workers and their ability to seek medical care has come up, for example, during the COVID-19 pandemic with the issue of health checkups and vaccinations. The fear was that because there are 50,000 or so or more undocumented migrant workers, some might be afraid to come in for health inspections, leading to a loophole that would lead to COVID-19 clusters. And there's questions of then vaccinations. What paperwork do you have to turn in if you're undocumented? People might be afraid to get vaccinated. And the government said they would be not checking this. There was some contention between government bureaus. And then still there are incidents in which police did check paperwork. And so I think that's the issue, is that there is not this reckoning, I think, with the immigration regime in Taiwan as it exists and these inequalities that it leads to, because this is not exactly a new issue either.
Well, Ryan, I'm going to push back a little bit because I think it's fair that Taiwanese society is more concerned with the child who may have been murdered in foster care or in child care because, you know, it's a terrible crime. Whereas the migrant worker's child died from a disease and then perhaps delayed treatment. I think, you know, both are really serious and there has been concern. You know, legislators have been, you know, that's why the Ministry of Labor is coming out with this guide. Now you can criticize that for being too late, and I would. And you know, will it really do that much good? Yes, these guides set up standards for what employers are supposed to do, and they do raise awareness. You know, there is confusion among employers about what they should do in this situation. So it may help in some cases, but it's an enormously complex problem. I would just point out that there are some commonalities in all these cases. The little girls who were hit by the truck in Zhanghua, their mother had remarried and their father was in prison. The child who was in foster care was in foster care because his mother had been arrested and then eventually became a fugitive from the law. And I guess his grandmother felt that she didn't have the resources to take care of him, and this was in his best interest. And then in the case of the migrant workers, obviously you have undocumented migrant workers and undocumented caregivers, and it causes problems like delayed medical treatment or no social workers visiting these children and their care situation at all, which obviously is very risky. So clearly we're not doing enough.
And of course, Brian, the Premier, on Thursday came out and ordered a review of proposals to establish a specialised agency to strengthen the protections afforded to children and youth, without specifying whether it was for undocumented or documented children or local children or foreign children. But I presume he meant all children. He also, of course, called on the Ministry of Health to conduct a comprehensive review of the placement process for children in foster care, and also asked the Health Ministry to propose amendments to the Protection of Children and Youths and Welfare and Rights Act to better enhanced child protection, Brian.
Well, I mean, that's the hope if it does that. But I think a lot of the issue with actually all of these issues, whether for undocumented children or not, is the pushback between government sections trying to foist responsibilities onto each other and the many stakeholders that then conflict with their different interests. And I think that's an issue regarding children, regardless, actually, and there are different stakeholders with each issue, and that adds to complexity. And I think there will be some performative action done for the sake of media attention being on this issue currently, but will actually lead to reform. I hope so, and it's a question.
And social workers did shoot back at the criticism, of course, Brian, with a protest outside the Ministry of Health building this week, saying that because the government said it's going to step up the frequency of visits to foster children. But they fired back, that's not the problem. The problem is a labour shortage, because there's not enough social workers, A, to help local children, or B, to ensure that undocumented children don't die or get sick.
It's interesting because this takes place at a time in which there's major departures from the medical profession because of the extraordinary pressure and burden at present. And I think it may be similar with social workers in the sense. I also think it's quite interesting that there's maybe a commonality of that. For example, if you ever go to an ER in Taiwan, there's all these signs saying do not assault the medical workers. And I have broken up incidents in ERs where that has occurred. And I think that this is a case in which now society has really turned against social workers in this way. I can even just see further departures or people being less interested in this work after these incidents. So I think that's the other side of this controversy.
Well, it was exacerbated by the fact that the social worker responsible for the Taiwanese child who died in foster care was arrested, and then, you know, months after the event and after an investigation, and then paraded around on TV in handcuffs in a very performative. And I think social workers and other parts of civil society were pretty outraged by her treatment. Social workers in Taiwan typically make about 40,000 NT a month. They work long hours, and many families do not want their children, especially women, to get involved in this profession because it can be dangerous because of the visits that they have to make to, you know, vulnerable communities or people who have serious mental health and other problems. I am encouraged by the fact that the Ministry of Health and Welfare has been put in charge of the project of protecting the rights and interests of undocumented migrant children. Historically, the Ministry of Health and Welfare has taken very pragmatic approaches to social issues like this. For example, long ago, they established a program where intravenous drug users could access hypodermic needles that vastly cut down the transmission of AIDS and HIV in Taiwan. And then during the pandemic, they set up places where undocumented migrant workers could come in without fear of being arrested or deported so that they could get vaccinated and treated if necessary. So I expect them to take a sensitive and pragmatic approach to taking care of these children. So that's one encouraging sign.
And before we go this week, we're going to move to a bit more light-hearted tone now. As the Ministry of Economic Affairs released this week the latest data on the island's convenience stores, which if you live here, you'll be fully aware, well, there's rather an abundance of them. Now, according to the ministry, Taiwan had 13,706 convenience stores, or one per 1,703 people, as of the end of last year. And based on Taiwan's population of 23.34 million million people. That means convenience store density here in Taiwan is now ahead of Japan, but behind South Korea. Now, the largest convenience store chain here is, of course, 7-Eleven, which has 6,859 stores, while Family Mart takes second place with 4,234 stores as of the end of last year. And the Economics Ministry says, backed by a 3.4% increase in the number of outlets, convenience store operators may generated record revenues last year of 412.6 billion NT. And the Economics Ministry says the record revenues come as convenience store chains are diversifying their product line by launching cross-branded products with prestigious brands and famous restaurants, and also by offering more services and methods that customers can choose to pay by them. If you're interested, apparently, alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages accounted for 60% of the convenience store chain's 2023 revenue. So, Michael, that's a lot of convenience stores and a lot of money.
It sure is. As we, all of us people living in Taiwan, know, convenience stores are central to life because they not only sell products like drinks, but they're also an important hub for all kinds of services, from copying or picking up HSR tickets or sending packages and so on, paying bills and this sort of thing. And, you know, they're so central to life that over the years, I've heard of couples who were breaking up who had to divide the 7-Eleven between them as well as their pets. You know, I won't go to this 7-Eleven to avoid embarrassing encounters in the future and this kind of thing. And so they're really central to life, and they're spreading to places that they weren't before. I've recently noticed on cycling trips that they're now going into indigenous communities, usually ones that, you know, have some tourist trade and that kind of thing. And, you know, you might think that that's a aggressive imposition of consumer society, but it's true that, you know, that there are a lot of visitors who are trooping into them, but it's also very obvious that they're a community center in places that are pretty quiet. They're open all the time. They're a place where people can hang out and talk and have coffee, and the communities are using them, not just the visitors. So I expect further exciting developments with convenience stores in Taiwan in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of why I think 7-Eleven and other convenience store chains started introducing seating a few years back and rapidly expanding this, knowing that in many communities or even in urban centers, this could be the case. The flip side is that this allows for certain companies, such as, let's say, Uniprecedent that owns 7-Eleven, to become a very influential site. And it is massive. It's a conglomerate, has a lot of influence. And the working conditions for 7-Eleven or other convenience store workers then are quite difficult because they're taking on so much roles. They are bank tellers dealing with the ATM. They're baristas. Fundamentally, 7-Eleven, the structure of it is a supermarket. There's been some attempts to organize, actually, among convenience store workers. It's not really gotten places. But it's actually interesting to me because of the density and the fact that one convenience store is servicing around like 1,700 people. It reminds me of the constituency of a Lijiang, for example, a borough chief. I mean, I wonder if that's where in the future people start campaigning, just the local 7-Eleven as it serves a community.
And do you think they could unionize convenience store workers?
Actually, it's interesting because a lot of the framing is similar to drawn from attempts to unionize fast food workers in the U.S. And that's proven challenging. And so it's similar here. Often it's young people that are doing these jobs.
There was a very good, I thought, article in the Los Angeles Times that ran just the other day that really does a great job of explaining why 7-Elevens or other convenience stores are so central to life in Taiwan. It was notable, though, to me that the article failed to mention that the cost of all that convenience comes at a high price for the workers in those stores, who the numbers never increase, but the numbers of services that they're being asked to provide are increasing all the time. And in some ways, they're almost like a community. In my neighborhood in Da'an District in Taipei, where 22% of the population is over 65, they play a pretty important role, like Brian was saying, in elder care. You have, you know, very old members of our community who are coming in confused. They can't count their change. They need to make minor purchases. And the 7-Eleven staff, I think, do a wonderful job of being kind and caring to them. But it's yet another service that is being placed on their shoulders. The one thing that is interesting, that at least in Taipei City, we're seeing a very interesting change where in the convenience stores in my neighborhood, the majority of employees are now older people, I would say 50 or above. Whereas I noticed coming out here to the studio that the convenience stores here have traditional young workers.
Yeah, I also think it's quite interesting looking at the examples of other countries in the region in which you do then have migrant workers taking up these jobs, or even foreign students, for example, such as in Japan. And that's then a sign of certain industries and opening up to migrant workers in a way. And I think Taiwan, that's interesting to look at based then on the regional precedent. But yeah, absolutely. I think there's a wonderful book written on 7-Eleven and other convenience stores. It's in Chinese. I'm blanking on the title. That second half of the book is basically a spiel to unionize. But it is quite interesting, actually, just the details, even going through the day of a 7-Eleven worker, even within 10 minutes, what a convenience store worker is doing between all of these different tasks.
It's a really tough job. I'm full of admiration for them.
But my question is, can you still send a fax from a 7-Eleven or a Family Mart?
I don't know, but you certainly, I don't think you would need to anymore, because you can scan a document and send it through your phone very easily.
I've also seen interaction where there's a new worker and they don't know 7-Eleven or any other convenience store can do certain things. The senior workers explain to them, yeah, we can actually do this. Yeah. And they're like, really? Wow, I didn't know that.
And that's where we'll leave it here this week on Taiwan This Week. And I'm joined in the studio today by Brian Hugh.
Good night.
And by Michael Fahey.
Take care.
And thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Taiwan This Week here on ICRT with me, Gavin Phipps. And don't forget to check out Taiwan This Week podcast on your favourite podcast app when you get access to all our previous shows.
Tune in again next Friday evening at 9 for another informative look at the top stories of the week with Taiwan This Week. And don't forget to also check out our podcast on our website, icrt.com.tw. Now keep it here for more music and news only on ICRT FM 100.